This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello on today's programme, writers who just can't stop writing.
I've just sold my father's kettle, so I'm looking for a nice house in the city. And then I would find an office and start my own business. I'm going to open a detective agency.
The adaptation of the number one ladies' detective agency by Alexander McCall Smith. As he approaches his 100th book, I'll be talking to him about the pros and cons of such prodigious output. And with grim stories from Pakistan featuring daily in news reports, we celebrate some good news. Two of the country's leading writers discuss why it's on a literary roll. First, though, one of Oxford University's youngest ever undergraduates, long-time investigative journalist and now one of Britain's most celebrated crime writers, Val McDermid. In the past, she's been accused of being bloodthirsty, credited with creating a string of dead bodies and gratuitous violence toward women, an accusation she continues to refute. Her latest novel certainly doesn't fit that stereotype. Trick of the Dark is a compelling page-turner, as much about the vagaries of human relationships and the scars of childhood as it is about the string of mysterious murders at the heart of the story. Charlie Flint is a recently suspended psychological profiler who finds herself drawn into the role of investigator when a mysterious bundle of newspaper clippings documenting a murder on the grounds of her fictional Oxford Ladies' College arrives on her Manchester doorstep. In pursuit of the truth, she reconnects with J. McCallan Stewart, another St. Scholastica's graduate, dot-com millionaire, potentially ruthless killer, and fellow lesbian. Unique in placing two same-sex couples at the heart of a mainstream crime thriller, it's not the only reason it feels like Val's most autobiographical novel to date. Minus the murders, of course. Val McDermid joins me now. Val, 7 years it's been since you wrote a novel with a lesbian protagonist. All three of this book's central characters are female and gay. It feels like you made a very deliberate choice to do that. Why?
Well, it wasn't really a deliberate choice to write a lesbian novel. It was the story that I'd been hanging around in the back of my head for a long, long time. And the only way to make this story work was for the characters to be lesbians, because at the heart of this book are triangles, the triangular relationships. And in a way, the book is also about the kind of triangle between the truth and lies and love. And if you have a heterosexual triangle, it becomes problematic because someone keeps falling off the triangle. It's hard to do the A loves B loves C loves A quite so effectively.
Charlie and Jay, your two lead characters, both went to an all-female college at Oxford where they had their sexual awakening. One a much more sinister sort of woman than the other, but both vulnerable and romantic, both flawed personalities, one risk-taking, one risk-averse. Are they both you?
I think, well, inevitably all your characters have some element of yourself in them, but if they're both me, they're also both not me, in a sense. I've drawn on my experience of Oxford in the sense of ambience and the kind of people you find there and the kind of things that happen there, but not directly much on my own direct experience. So in one sense it is autobiographical, in another sense it very definitely isn't.
It is vaguely critical of the sort of insular nature of Oxford colleges, where it would be far better for a murder to be written off as a nasty accident than actually draw the school into disrepute.
I think there's some element of that, or certainly perhaps there used to be. I think that's less so now. Certainly my own experiences with St Hilda's, where I was an undergraduate, suggest to me that now if there was a murder, they would actually put their hands up and say, yes, there's been a murder. I think certainly maybe, you know, when I was an undergraduate, they would have gone all round the houses to try and avoid it being classified as such.
They might say there's been a murder, but perhaps not in your accent.
Certainly not in my accent, no.
Which was an experience you had at college that finds its way into this book, isn't it? Jay is stopped in the book, mid-sentence, by a tutor who can't understand her.
Yes, actually, that is a genuine incident that did happen to me. I mean, sometimes things are too good not to put in a book. I was at my very first tutorial about Gerard Manley Hopkins, The Wreck of the Deutschland, and I was sort of in the middle of the second paragraph and my tutor stopped me and said, I'm most frightfully sorry, Miss McDermid, but I haven't understood a word you've said.
Oh, ouch.
And I just wanted to curl up and die. So the first thing I learned to do was to speak English. Because when I went to Oxford, I had a very, very dense Fife accent. And people from Fife speak very quickly as well, which didn't help matters.
Is there still a resistance, do you think, to putting gay characters centre stage? I mean, obviously not for you, as you have four or five of them in this book, but, I mean, particularly in a mainstream genre like crime, it feels to me that there is still a sort of resistance. I noticed that your lesbian investigative journalist, Lindsay Gordon, hasn't made it to the small or indeed the big screen. Do you think that's just pure coincidence?
I don't think it's just pure coincidence, no. Everything else I've ever written has been at least investigated for option by television or film. I think there is a reluctance. I think you're right. I think it's changed tremendously. I think that the landscape has changed enormously since I wrote that first Lindsay Gordon novel, which was published in 87. It would have been inconceivable at that point that a mainstream publisher would have published a novel with a lesbian protagonist. But at this point, I mean, my publisher didn't even bat an eyelid. I think it would be harder if you were starting out. If this was my first novel, it would have probably been a bit harder. There would have been a bit more resistance. But I think because I have a certain reputation, I think people who know my books enjoy them and will take a punt, will come on the journey with me and in the hope that it'll be the kind of storytelling they expect.
Did it feel like you were doing something, I don't want to use the word brave, but were you conscious of the fact that it could be something that would backfire?
I was aware there were possibilities for that, but I mean, you know, I've let Sarah Waters do the hard labour on that front, you know. It's like, let Sarah Waters, Emma Donoghue carry the weight, I'll just come up behind in their slipstream, you know.
You're a fan of Scandinavian crime fiction, which in many cases really acts as a prism for modern society in Scandinavia today. Do you think we do enough of that in the UK, and should it be at the heart of books about violence in our society?
I think that the best of crime fiction does do that, and has been doing it really since the late 1990s in the UK. I mean, writers like John Harvey, like Minette Walters, like Ian Rankin have been doing this kind of work, where you use the crime novel as a way of shining the searchlight down on society. Some books that I read from the younger writers coming through are still doing this, others are not, and I think to not do this is to miss a trick, really, to miss a chance to really broaden your book out, to give it much more texture and much more richness. And it's also, I mean, I suppose it's a way that we can express our own personal politics, if you like, and that doesn't necessarily have to be the politics of the left.
There are certain crimes which could be seen to define generations. You know, the Moors murderers, certainly one, the Jamie Bulger case, another, a whole sort of generation influenced by those events, struggling to kind of make sense of it. Do you think that's true? Do you think in part working those crimes is part of what you do, chewing them over? And
I think inevitably there are events that happen in the public sphere that for all of us shape the way that we think. And often it is something that happens at a particular time in our life. I mean, I can remember as a child growing up in Scotland, I mean, I remember the Moors murders in a vague kind of way. But what I remember are the Bible John killings. That was the kind of keynote killings for me in that period, because they were happening in Scotland and that was what was getting a lot of media coverage. So, yeah, those things, I think, do impact on your psyche. And whether you're conscious of going back and revisiting those, you inevitably do go back and revisit those, particularly if there were things that retained an element of mystery about it. With the Moors murders, I think people still think, why did they do these things? How did Myra Hindley let herself be drawn into this? And with Bible John, of course, the case was never resolved. There was never anybody definitely proven guilty of those crimes. So for me, I suppose there's a big seed there of the crime writing, of finding out the answers, of weaving your way through these clues to try and nail something down.
Thank you very much, Val McDermid. Trick of the Dark is out now, published by Little Brown. Val has to date published almost 30 books, quite a lot, you might think, particularly given the amount of articles and features she also wrote while she was a journalist, but small fry to fellow Scot Alexander McCall Smith, whose 96th book is published this month. Best known for his number one Ladies Detective Agency and Sunday Philosophy Club series, he's also written one-offs, academic books, and has published many, many titles for children. But is such prolific creativity a good thing, or does it impact on the quality of the writing? Is there a snobbery about those who write fast? We'll discuss the subject further in a moment, but first, Alexander McCall-Smith tells me how he does it. I began by asking him how long it took to write his latest book, The Charming Quirks of Others.
That took me, I should imagine, about 3 months, in that normally I would allocate about that period for one of my principal series, for each principal series each year, so about 3 months. I suppose I could, if really pressed, write a novel in a shorter time than that, but I don't like to rush these things too much.
You say that The Charming Quirks of Others took 3 months, and that's about average. So how long are your writing days if you're writing an entire book in 3 months?
Well, I would say that I would write about 3 hours a day. That seems to me to be about the limit that I can manage. I could sometimes do a little bit more than that, but it is quite draining emotionally, and I think it's intellectually tiring as well. So the way I managed to get all this done is that I'm very fortunate and very aware of my good fortune in being able to write quite quickly. So I write 1,000 words an hour, and some days I'd write about 5,000 words a day. Not all writers do that. I think Flaubert wrote 35 words a week. Very good words. They were very good words, but 35.
Well, you see, but therein lies another question, which is that there is a sense, isn't there, that, you know, if you've laboured 10 years to create your masterpiece, then in some way it's far more serious and relevant than the book that you've sort of banged out in 2 months.
Well, yes and no. I think that people work in different ways, and some people do require that very long period of contemplation to produce a couple of pages, and others don't. My way of writing is, I think, probably a little bit odd, in that I don't have to sit there and think about what is going to happen. I go into what I might perhaps describe as a sort of a trance. It's a minor dissociative state. In which I'm aware of my surroundings, so I'm not unconscious. But what I'm doing is I'm gaining access to the subconscious mind, that part of the subconscious mind which actually is creating the narrative, the fictional narrative. And I don't really have to think about that in a conscious way. So it's almost as if I'm dreaming.
Isabel Dalhousie, your philosopher sleuth, is the heroine of the Sunday Philosophy Club series. And I wondered how helpful recurring characters, I mean, your most famous, of course, being Mara Motswe, and settings, recurring settings, whether Edinburgh or Botswana, are when you're as prolific a writer as yourself.
Well, I think it certainly helps to be writing series of books because you are then familiar not only with the characters but with the setting and with their domestic circumstances and so on. And so when one returns to a series and starts a new novel in a series, it's rather like meeting an old friend.
But when you meet an old friend, you can sometimes find that you've forgotten an awful lot about them. Do you find that? Do you have to reread to sort of remind yourself of where you've taken them and who they've met and where they've been?
Well, now, that is a very interesting question, because I have certainly in the past, I have forgotten aspects of the lives of characters, and because I haven't been disciplined enough to go back and reread the books all the time and remember details, I have occasionally said something about a character which is contradicts something I've said in a previous book. Sometimes we've discovered that parents who died in the character's childhood have miraculously reappeared later on. And the only thing in those circumstances, the only thing you can do is you hold up your hands and say, guilty.
Alexander McCall-Smith. He's not alone, though, in the rate at which he writes. Alexandre Dumas wrote almost 300 books. Maigret creator George Simenon more than 500. And Enid Blyton managed over 700. But it isn't always perceived as a good thing. If it takes years to create a single book, you're thought creative and high-minded. If you can churn it out over a weekend, you're considered a lightweight. Chief fiction reviewer for the Sunday Times, Peter Kemp, has been looking at writers who can't hold back. He's here with me. Peter, first of all, what motivates writers, do you think, to write lots and lots and lots of books?
I think there are two general motivations. The first one is an urgent need for money. If you look at some of the people who poured out lots of books, they were doing it to pay off debts. Something like Walter Scott, who was quite prolific already, but in the later stage of his life, he got embroiled in a terrific financial disaster, was determined to pay off his debts and just wrote novel after novel after novel to do that. So there's the need to make money. But more interestingly, I think, there's the matter of psychological compulsion, which I think fires a lot of writers. If you think of somebody like Balzac, for instance, who wrote over 100 novels, short stories and plays, wore out quite a lot of chairs just sitting at his desk writing these. And he always grumbled and said, oh, you know, I'm just a galley slave to pen and ink. But I don't believe, nobody press ganged him to write them. I mean, he wanted to do it. He really, I think, got enormous satisfaction out of being a very profuse writer.
Are there writers who really stand out even more for their prolific output?
There are. There are a number of them. I mean, if you just go like a little bit back in the crime writing genre, you've mentioned Simenon. Well, 400, 500 novels. People still seem to be slightly unsure of the figure. Enormous display of energy. When you factor in his claim that while he was writing these novels, he bedded 10,000 women. I mean, it's pretty incredible energy, I think. Edgar Wallace, again, produced...
But who suffered, do you think, the women or the books?
I suspect the women. I suspect the women. And the number of books we can check on, the number of women, is harder to be positive about. Someone like Edgar Wallace, I mean, 175 novels, 24 plays. He speeded up a lot by dictating his novels. And there used to be a standing joke, in fact, that if someone phoned him and they were told, oh, Mr. Wallace can't come to the phone, he's busy writing a novel, they'd say, well, that's fine, I'll hang on, because he would be finished so quickly. Nowadays, I mean, a writer who's, you know, productiveness absolutely astonishes me is Joyce Carol Oates. To date, I mean, she's published 39 novels, 8 novellas, 36 volumes of short stories, 10 volumes of poetry, 8 books for children or young adults, and 10 non-fiction books.
I mean, Peter.
You feel worn out by the time you've read her bibliography, and you start wondering, it's almost some sort of conglomerate, you know, somebody called Joyce, somebody called Carol, and someone called Oates.
Well, interesting that you say, you know, you start thinking it's some sort of conglomerate. Do you think that it has an impact on the writers in question, their reputations? Do you think that it suggests something less serious, less considered?
I think it does. I mean, I think it satisfies a certain audience who want more of the same. Because, of course, if you're producing on that scale, you're bound to become repetitive and so on, and recycling effects. But I do think it raises eyebrows and people think it can't be that good. I mean, you know, it is famously harder to write a short book than a long book, really. You need to put in revision and compression and so on. The thing you have to be careful of is saying that because an author wrote an awful lot, everything they wrote is substandard. If you think of somebody like Anthony Trollope, yes, he wrote a lot, and of course they're very long books, each book as well. There are some that aren't that great, but there are lots of masterpieces there as well. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind as also.
And there are lots of writers who take 10 years to write each book, and even then they're not necessarily masterpieces.
Well, that is true. That's one of the things you cheer yourself up with, isn't it, really?
Indeed. Thank you very much, Peter Kemp. And Alexander McCall Smith's 96th book, The Charming Quirks of Others, is out this month, published by Little Brown. You're listening to Open Book on Radio 4 with me, Mariella Frostrup. It's been nearly 30 years since Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children thrust Indian literature smack bang into the middle of the international stage. In the years that followed, Indian authors garnered acclaim, becoming notable prize winners and bestsellers around the globe. But what of their counterparts across the border? Until recently, Pakistani fiction has had a much less dramatic impact on the literary map, despite the country's dominance of newspaper front pages. Now, though, a new generation of Pakistani writers has started to break through, with Booker nominees like Mohsin Hamid and Muhammad Hanif showcasing the country's burgeoning literary scene and its growing profile. The latest edition of the literary magazine Grant is entirely devoted to new Pakistani writing, and two of its contributing authors, Carmila Shamsi and Danyal Moinuddin, join me now. Carmila is the author of 5 novels, including the Orange Prize-nominated Burnt Shadows, and Danyal's debut collection of short stories, In Other Rooms, Other Wonders, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Carmila, you're one of the most established writers on the Pakistani scene. Do you feel that there is a new wave, a real new wave?
Yes and no. It's true that 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, I would not have been asked to be on a panel about Pakistani writing. So there is a certain excitement. But a friend of mine did say, if 5 of you constitute a wave, that just shows what a drought there was before, which I think sort of sums it up.
I wondered, as a Pakistani writer, whether both of you feel a sort of weight of responsibility, in some ways perhaps a sort of claustrophobic pressure, to tackle the issues in Pakistan today, that you can't somehow just be a writer in Pakistan. You have to be a writer who's writing about the here and now in a way that perhaps, you know, British writers don't feel the same imperative. You're shaking your head, Danyal.
I'm saying absolutely not. I think that part of having artistic integrity is not having a political position and not standing on soapboxes. There's no way. I write what I like. Mm. Pakistan is a place where if you put 3 Pakistanis in a room and then you're a betting man, you can bet that there's a 98% chance, likelihood, that these guys are going to sit down and talk about politics.
Yeah.
That's what we do. We talk about politics all the time. That's all we talk about. Mm. And this permeates our lives in a way that it doesn't, you know, in other places. And therefore, as a writer, that obviously that is woven into this sort of, into the fabric of what you think and do and feel and are. And therefore, yes, we're political, but we're not consciously political, and we're not political with an agenda. It's just that's where we come from.
But I wondered what else the members of this Pakistani new wave of writing have in common.
Sounds so good. I like that. The Pakistani new wave. I feel like I'm French and cool in the 50s.
You're Pakistani and cool, which has got to be even better, surely.
I had someone write me the other day and say, can I refer to all of you as the Pack Pack?
The Pack Pack. Oh, my God. I'm not sure about that one.
Aside from writing in English, right, which is obviously makes all of you eligible for the Booker, which is probably a good thing, I suppose. What's the commonality between you all?
We're so radically different.
Danyal write more about rural life, which is a million miles from Karachi urban life. Karachi urban life in some ways more like someone writing about certain parts of London. So it's very dramatically different. Nadeem will write about Pakistani communities in Britain sometimes. So there is, even in terms of geographically, thematically, stylistically, which is
I think
the
stylistically
main thing.
Is the big one. I think that in terms of style, we're just radically different from each other. And Kamala's work and my work and Nadeem's work and Hanif's work, it's all very, very different.
What about writing in English? How does that affect the work?
It's the only language I know well enough to write. And I don't know if I'm assuming it's the same for you, Danyal.
Yeah, it is.
And it's not true for all of us. Hanif couldn't write Urdu just as well. But it is the only language. What happens then is, I don't know that it makes a difference to the writing itself. It makes a difference to the response, because it means that the people you're reaching are different. Pakistan has had tremendous Urdu language writers. I don't know that much about the other languages, but certainly Urdu language writing in the 70s and 80s was extraordinary and wonderful. And no one, in London then was talking about the new wave of Pakistani writing. So it is a question of access and who you're reaching and translation. There's a lot more translation from English into other languages. But it also means that as a result, within Pakistan, people say, you're giving outsiders a viewpoint of us, so maybe you should speak differently than if you were speaking in Urdu, which of course we all ignore. But there's a sense within Pakistan that that we are representing the nation to the outside world.
But the other thing, you know, there's this feeling, this is odd feeling that, you know, because you're basically a Pakistani living in Pakistan, writing about Pakistan, but writing about it not for Pakistanis, you feel as if you're sort of a spy or something. You know, you're not connected. When most writers write, they write for their own people. I mean, we're not writing for our own people.
Why not?
Well, we're not right. I mean,
no,
to me,
are we, Kamala? I mean, who are you writing for in Pakistan? Friends and family, you know?
It's more than friends and family, Daniel. Well, I'll tell you what it is. With Pakistan, particularly my earlier books, which didn't have huge sales figures, and so were probably in numbers, didn't sell that much less in Pakistan than in America, actually.
But your point is that there aren't very many young Pakistanis reading new fiction.
English. I mean, look, it's a country of 180 million or something. Mm. Out of that, you know, probably what is our readership? 5,000, 3,000, 1,000? It's those kinds of numbers. It's minuscule. And also our reach. I mean, I live in a remote area. The guys who live around me think I'm bonkers because I sit in a room and type all day. And
that is bonkers.
It is bonkers. But they don't know what I'm doing. They can't even conceive of what I'm doing.
But I was going to ask you about that sort of insider-outsider effect. You've both lived in Pakistan and the US. Kamila also lives in London. So many of these writers, including Mohsin Hamid and Nadine Aslam, live between worlds. That seems to be a very important part of the writing.
If you live in more than one place, you start seeing both places in contrast to each other rather than just the place itself.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that has to, in some way, it, you know, the way I see London is influenced by living in Karachi and living in upstate New York.
Daniel, do you feel that same sense?
One thing that I think has a big impact is that one can get out. I mean, Pakistan is such a high-pressure place that when you're living there, you're going bonkers, you know, you just are. And to know that you can go away from it, I think makes, in a way, the writing is almost unbearable. I mean, as you bear down upon these subjects, the weight of it is so great and the impact upon you personally as you write it is so great. You know, there is a price in writing about these things. But at the back of your mind, you know, I can get away. And I think that it would be much more difficult to do it in the way I do it if I didn't know I could get away.
Speaking of there being a price, and the novelist Mohsin Hamid's contribution to this edition of Grant is a very short, rather shocking piece about a man being beheaded by unknown terrorists for being a writer of some kind, a sort of extreme fictional version, but really of a real fear for writers writing in your part of the world.
It's not about being a writer. That's not why you're under threat. I think you're just under threat for being a Pakistani and being there and being somewhat visible.
I certainly have never felt under threat for being a writer. You know, historically, it's been the writers in other languages of Pakistan who've been under more threat. There were a lot of, in the 80s, a lot of the Urdu writers were sent into exile or imprisoned because they could reach people in Pakistan and that made them threatening to the state. English language writers, actually, you live in this sort of rarefied space where the state doesn't see you as nearly as threatening.
People who write slim volumes of short stories are not threatening to Mr. Zardari and company.
Is that why you included a love poem in this collection?
Being really careful, you know. I wanted to be extra double careful.
Love is as political as it gets.
Thank you very much, Carmila Shamsi and Danielle Moynadin. The Pakistan edition of Granta is out now. Next week, I'll be talking to author Susan Hill about putting the fear and menace into her new ghost story, and to novelist Joanna Trollope about the power and pleasure of reading aloud. Join me then. Goodbye.